This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, thanks very much for downloading this. I'm Mark Stephen. We build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast out the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, and obviously this being the first programme of the new year, 2021, we thought we'd take a look back at some of the podcasts we did last year, just some of the highlights, some of the excerpts. And we also took a wander round a rather remarkable stone circle in Aberdeenshire. Here we go. Hello and a very good morning to you, and of course a happy new year as well. I hope you had a peaceful and a restful festive season and you think you enjoyed it and got a chance to sort of at least meet some of your family occasionally. I'm Mark Stephen, live once more from the BBC Aberdeen car park. It's still dark, it's still raining in 2021. Joining me to kick the year off from his garden in rural Bampshire, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Good morning, hopefully not suffering too much from the excesses of New Year's Day. Thankfully we can stop now and just give it a rest. We'd love to know what you're up to and about. Give us an email, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. The text number is 80295. And Sam's taking your calls. He's in as well. 08085 9295 00.
Just give you a quick update on the BBC Aberdeen car park foxes. One of them went past this morning, but was carrying a back leg. Something's wrong with one of its back legs. So aside from that, it seemed to be quite cheery. You never know. Coming up, we're going to be taking a look back at some of our favourite guests from our Scotland Outdoor podcast from 2020, including folk singer Kareen Polwart and sound recordist Chris Watson.
As well as I've been delving into some of Shetland's mythology, and you've been getting out and about looking at a northeast stone circle.
Yeah, this part of the world is really rich in what's known as recumbent stone circles, and I went out with a guy called Hayden Lorimer just to take a look at one of them near Echt. The wonderful thing about this, nobody really knows what they were absolutely for. You know, nobody can say definitively this was the purpose of this stone circle. So we just went out and had a very fruitful time speculating, to be honest. We've got no mystery bird this week, but just for a little bit of fun, we do have a sound for you to listen to. Now, we are all, as a team, utterly convinced that nobody, but nobody, is going to get this. But I am just intrigued to hear what you might think it might be.
Now, it's definitely not a bird, but let your imagination run wild. I mean, I was in this interview, and I can remember what it was. It's a very strange sound. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, give us a ring, 08085 9295 00. Just let your brain run wild with that one, because, as Mark said, there's not a hope of you getting it right.
Here it is again, quickly. No, not a clue. Absolutely not a clue. Now, this game is a complete surprise to me when we interviewed him. The BBC security correspondent, Frank Gardner, is actually a very keen bird watcher. Now, we came by this information. We had Frank on the programme in spring in his role as president of the British Trust for Ornithology.
Now, yeah, the live programme didn't allow us time to go into depth about Frank's love of birds, but the Scotland Outdoors podcast did. And here's a wee excerpt from that podcast where Frank explains where his love of birdwatching comes from.
I was about nine. We were living in Holland, in the Netherlands. My mum got me into it. We lived in The Hague, but we'd go spend a lot of time on the North Sea. And, you know, I used to say, what are those things dangling around your neck? And she said, they're binoculars. Have a look. And I became quite intrigued at that. And at the age of 10, I started mapping out the nests and stuff where we were and when we moved to Hampshire. And we had a fantastic holiday when I was 10 up in the Highlands, actually in Loch Torridon. And that was really quite a formative moment for me, because we got to this remote tarn and my mum and I had been talking, wouldn't it be amazing if we could see a diver? A diver is what the Americans call a loon. It's basically like a large, almost like a large duck, a seabird. And they do exactly what they say. They dive a lot. And they've got this fantastic, eerie call that just speaks of the far north. And there on the tarn was a black-throated diver. It's the only one I've ever seen in my life. And that was near Deer Baig, up in the northwest. It was just a thrilling moment.
You became interested in birds, as you say, about age of 9 or 10. Like a lot of teenagers, you went off the boil. You just put them to the back burner for a while. You came back to them years later. Why? Tell me the story behind that.
Yeah, I kind of gave it up when I was about 13. And it wasn't until nearly 20 years later. I was living in Bahrain. I was working in the Gulf, running the office for a Scottish bank, actually, Robert Fleming. I worked for them for 5 years, running their Middle East operations. And my mum came out to stay, and we went for a picnic in this lovely palm grove. It was about this time of year, maybe a bit earlier, April, and this bright yellow bird flashed past as we were having this picnic, and then a bright red one. And I thought, what are those? And so I contacted the local Natural History Society guy, a Welshman, Howard King, and it turned out that the yellow one was a golden oriole that was on migration. It was probably coming up from via Yemen, coming up through the Gulf, heading up to Russia. And the red one was just an escaped cage bird, a bird called a red avidavit that you get in India, and that had escaped. But it kind of pricked my interest, and then I started bird watching around this tiny island of Bahrain and finding that there were familiar birds like curlews that I'd seen in Britain were there. And I was amazed that this tiny little island with a population of less than 1 million had such a rich bird life. Everything from even passing eagles to avocets and spoonbills, some really quite exotic birds, but also a lot of the familiar ones like thrushes that we would see. In the Arab world, it is quite dangerous to be walking around with a pair of binoculars because in the Middle East, and I guess that would include Israel, Iran, Turkey, there is quite a lot of suspicion, I think, about a Westerner with binoculars. What are they up to? Why are they taking notes? They must be a spy. So I used to do quite a lot in Saudi Arabia. I'd go to the southwest. People think Saudi Arabia is all just flat and desert and concrete highways. It's not. It's actually amazingly diverse. Down in the southwest, you've got mountains going up to 3,000 metres, juniper forests, great plunging valleys. You've got hornbills and other fantastic African species there. So what I would do is I would go along to the local National Guard there, which is like a sort of defence, national defence militia. I'd sit down, I'd introduce myself, I'd have a cup of tea with them, we'd chat away in Arabic, and I'd say, look, this is what I'm going to be doing. And they would offer me every help they could. If I didn't do that, someone would report me and I would get arrested. And I'd then have to explain all over again what I was doing.
Frank, tell me about the programme you did with Benedict Allen.
Yeah, this was a great idea. Benedict Allen is an explorer, and it's kind of a slightly dated expression there, but he really is. He went off in his 20s and lived for months with a remote tribe in Papua New Guinea, and he underwent their initiation ceremony, which involved like 200 razor cuts all over his torso, which he's quite proud of, but he underwent that to become part of their crocodile tribe, as they called themselves. And I met him in London at some event, some traveller's event, whatever, and I said, I wish I'd gone to Papua New Guinea before I was in a wheelchair, because I got shot 16 years ago on assignment in Saudi Arabia. One of the bullets nicked the spinal nerves, so my legs don't work that well, and I use a wheelchair. And he said, don't worry, I bet we can get you to Papua New Guinea. So he talked to his agents, I talked to my agents, they got together, they came up with a proposal, and the BBC thought, yeah, this is quite a good idea. The idea of searching for this bird of paradise that I had never seen down in Papua New Guinea. And it was a chance for him to reconnect with the tribe that he'd lived with. So we went in by dugout canoe. It was a long journey through mosquito-ridden malarial swamps. And we got to this village. And it was an amazing moment. They came out in the war canoes to greet him with the drums beating. All of them in their feathers and It was an incredible moment. It's a bit like that moment in Apocalypse Now where they get to the lair and the canoes come out. It was absolutely amazing. And we did get to see the Birds of Paradise, which, I mean, they are so aptly named. Sir David Attenborough just loves them because they are almost from another world, these birds, with their great big extravagant plumes and elaborate mating rituals and just these wonderful whooping cries high up in these misty forests, separated by these valleys, where you've got 700 different languages from 700 groups that often have never met each other.
BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner there on the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is still available on BBC Sounds, and we'll have more podcast pieces coming up throughout the programme. You mentioned Benedict Allen there, and you know, was it not Benedict Allen that got seriously lost at one stage? I mean, as in, for about 4 months he was lost.
Yeah, just disappeared, but it was great hearing Frank, because that was such an eye-opener of an interview, because I just didn't know about that love of birds. And he's been to some exotic places, obviously, but it's just a great raconteur and a real passion for bird life. If you recommend one podcast, I would go to that one.
Yeah, too straight. Anyway, during the summer, musician Anna Massey recorded a couple of pieces for us very kindly, one from her parents' home in Fortrose and the other at Clachtal near Lough Inver. Now, we asked Anna if she would record an end-of-year piece for us, for us in a similar location, but as ever with 2020, things were subject to change.
I travelled back down to Glasgow for work at the start of October and have had a really busy couple of months recording, filming and performing. It's been inspiring and exciting to see how the music industry is adapting to the pandemic. And as the vaccine rolls out, we dare to dream of getting back to some kind of live performances with actual audiences. The normal shape to my working year sees a busy November touring with both Myrid Green and Glazing Fiddles. Then various Christmas tours have filled my Decembers. So by the time it gets to the Christmas holidays, I'm usually pretty knackered, very grumpy and desperate for a wee break. The idea for today's recording was that I would be back home in Fortrose for Christmas and hit the beach again with the trusty hounds, Sonny and MacPhail in tow. As the announcement of tighter restrictions around Christmas was made, it became clear that travelling from Glasgow in Level 3 to Fortrose in Level 1 wasn't something that, for my family and I, was justifiable. You may be able to hear the sound of a reversing delivery van and a great deal more traffic than we would normally encounter in Fortrose. The end of 2020 makes the same demands as the rest of this year. Change. This is my first festive season apart from my parents, and the first in Glasgow. So, today, rather than a walk on the beach, we're taking a stroll by the River Kelvin. It's quieter than the street here, and it's about the best chance of getting to clap any dogs that I can think of. I live near St George's Cross, right at the end of Great Western Road, or perhaps the beginning. This is the start of the A82. It's the second longest road in Scotland, after the A9, and it runs from just outside my flat, up the side of Loch Lomond, past Crianlarich, over Rannoch Moor, through Glencoe and Fort William. It bends its way up the Great Glen, past Achert Castle, skirts along Loch Ness side, then it becomes Tom na Hurich Street in Inverness, and ends just at the roundabout at the foot of the Keswick Bridge, where it joins the A9. So, I suppose, technically, you could say that I'm only really a couple of streets away from Fortrose. That's quite a nice way of thinking. All right, I'm trying to make a radio programme. Anyway, makes it feel a wee bitty closer when you think of it like that. At the very start of December, I set out along Great Western Road, and it felt like being in some sort of Christmas movie. The streets were full of folk meeting for a walk, sharing a takeaway coffee, humping Christmas trees along on their shoulders. As nowhere was open for sitting in, the usually bustling West End became even busier. It's been brilliant to see folk embracing outdoor socialising. The hiking boots and socks I bought in the sales last year are well worn in now. My wee flask has never known such action. It usually contains tea, but has been known to do a great job of keeping mulled wine glowy too. And the thing I am most proud and glad of are the wee folding insulated foam mats that now come everywhere with me. Damp park bench for a cuppa? Cold stone dyke for a piece in a blether? Protect you and your pals' posteriors with a portable pliable pad. How is that for alliteration? Although a dander around the village at home provides a good opportunity for eyeing up the neighbours' trees and decorations, the huge number of tenement flats in Glasgow gives at least four times as many They're just stacked up on top of each other. Apparently, in 2019, this area was included in a list of the 50 coolest neighbourhoods in the world by Time Out magazine. I mean, how do you even start with a list like that? But to be fair to Time Out, there are hundreds of students around here, a couple of very cool sourdough pizza places, countless coffee shops, and a lot of retro clothes shops. So, you know, that all sounds about right to me. We've hit Kelvin Bridge. We'll cross the famous Iron Bridge and take a left on the far side, coming down a wee staircase to get to the riverside path. There are two options here. We could turn right and head south into Kelvin Grove Park, but as my home and instinct is to head north at this time of the year, we'll turn left and see what gives along the riverside. We've passed under Kelvin Bridge, and now, rather than the rumble of lorries and buses and the noise of car engines, the background sound is that of the River Kelvin as it rushes past the feet of the bridge. Whereas the Clyde has been widened and deepened in the city to allow for trade and transport, the River Kelvin feels, to me anyway, to have kept more of a wild feel. Although I did see a sail in the Clyde last week, and that really threw me. As well as being a hive of industry and human activity, the Kelvin is also home to a vast array of wildlife. The odd heron, a very shy kingfisher from time to time, the occasional otter. It's easy to forget when you're living in a city that nature can be so close by. There are, of course, pigeons and squirrels for days around here, but they've all got a very urban and confident attitude towards humans and can be fairly intimidating. I spent a great deal of this summer in a rage with the aggressive scurries in Fortrose who were determined to snaffle the birdseed we put out in the feeders for the nice wee birds. I can't imagine the scene if a Glasgow pigeon found its way north. The Kelvin walkway can be a very romantic spot. Generations of courting couples have mooned along the riverside. In the romantic way, like no bare bums on the wireless, thank you please. It's a very common dog walking area. Many's the time you'll feel the swish of a clarty mutt trotting past your calf and leaving a muddy streak in its wake. I love it. This is a very popular cycle route, and you can often hear the angry ding of a cyclist's bell warning dawdling pedestrians to get out the way. There are always kids on scooters and bikes along here. In fact, between the scooters, the bikes and the dogs, the mooning couples would really need to keep their wits about them. Although, like so many folk this year, I'm not spending the festive season in the place or with the people I had planned. There are still a lot of lovely walks to take, folk to meet outside, and unfamiliar dogs to say hi to. All the best to you and yours for 2021. May it go more smoothly and more to plan than the previous year. Health, happiness and peace of mind. Oh, and mind to get yourself one of those wee mats to keep your bum cosy if you're going to be socialising outdoors.
Anna Massey there, with the startling information that generations of courting couples have mooned alongside the River Kelvin. Really? I used to walk along the River Kelvin on a regular basis. I've never seen that once. Serious?
That was stunning, Mark, just listening to that. I mean, there was so much information. Uh-huh. You know, the A82 stretch and all the way along.
I didn't
plastic
know that.
Plastic posterior protectors. Yeah, it was kind of 6 minutes of just non-stop information.
I'll tell you about the plastic posterior protectors and the portable pads. I've got one of the gifts I got at Christmas time came in a bubble wrap bag. And I have been using that to sit on. It's very thin, but it fairly insulates your bum.
Too much information.
Yeah, well, possibly. What do you use nowadays?
I use a reindeer skin. Trust me.
What, reindeer skin pants?
Well, so somebody on the programme a couple of weeks back said that, you know, that the ideal thing is reindeer.
Silly, yeah.
And it's just, and it is just wonderful. Sitting around, because we had a massive bonfire just in the run-up to New Year, and you're sitting outside, looking up at the stars, blazing fire. It was just a magical way to spend a couple of hours in other people's company. Obviously, on the other side of the fire, you know, about 4 metres apart, but just brilliant.
The old perennial question, sir. Far side in or far side out? Nobody knows. And talking of blazing, you may have caught Anna last night, along with other members of Blazing Fiddles, I thank you, on the BBC One Hogmanay programme. If not, you'll still be able to find it on the BBC iPlayer. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Mr. Ewan McElrath. We don't have a mystery bird this week, do we?
No, but we've got something you could argue is even better. Have a wee listen to this. I kind of thought it sounded like a washing machine, but have a listen.
Now, that is a genuine sound, and it's something making that sound. We've asked you basically just to guess wildly, because nobody's going to come up with an informed guess on this. Robin in Perth says, is the mystery noise the wasps chewing the wood, which was played many, many weeks ago? It's not, Robin, but it's a good guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Colin Scriven's been in touch. Said, morning, guys. Thanks for continuing to produce an excellent programme. Well, we don't produce it. We have Fiona who produces it. We just join the bits in the middle. An excellent programme throughout the year. Is it the sound of a singing bowl?
Ooh.
I can see where you're coming from. Yeah. All the best for 2021. Yeah, I kind of didgeridoo-type sensation there as well.
Indeed. Rosie in Cooper Angus says, would that sound be surface ice forming on water? All good wishes to the whole out-of-doors team for 2021. Always a treat on Saturday mornings. Thank you. Well, thank you, Rosie. And Karen in Shetland, Happy New Year. Karen says, Happy New Year to you all. It sounds like my trusty old Scandinavian meths burning camp stove starting up, spitting and crackling to make tea by candlelight. Ooh. In a power cut. Oh, don't tell me you got a power cut, Karen. Oh, no.
Wow, power cut's a great thing, especially if you've got a high-powered methylated Primus stove. I tell you what I did do over the festive season. Uh-huh. I made some Swedish candles. Now, you and I disagree about the definition of a Swedish candle, but this is the jet stove version.
Okay, right.
And they impressed the heck out of everybody. I had three of them lined up, uh-huh. and they were just wonderful. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, and give Sam a call, 08 085 92 95 00, and tell him what you think that sound is, because so far it's foxing everybody.
Chris Watson is an award-winning professional sound recordist who's worked with David Attenborough. He's spent a career gathering sound from across the globe. So when we asked him to curate a series of his favourite sounds for our Scotland Outdoors podcast earlier this year, we were absolutely thrilled when he said yes. Here's one of them.
This is a pod of orcas, killer whales, in the Ross Sea in Antarctica. I was down there for a television series called Frozen Planet 10 years ago, actually, and we went out onto the surface of a frozen ocean. I mean, it sounds bizarre. We've flown out there in a helicopter about 20 kilometres offshore, and these great cracks appear in the sea ice, which are called leads. And when they appear, the orcas swim up these cracks because they're hunting seals and penguins, and they're air-breathing mammals like us, so they need to be able to surface and take a breath. So they all come up these cracks and they're hunting and they're using their echolocation and they're making contact calls. And so I put my hydrophones into these cracks in the sea ice. Hydrophones are underwater microphones. And I made this recording as 20 or 30 orca pass by my hydrophones. The interesting thing is, of course, is it's known down there, people think of the poles as quiet, silent places, and they are very quiet when the wind's not blowing on the surface, but all the action is under the sea ice, and everything under the sea ice lives in a world of sound and vibration. So it's full of sound, it's a very sound-rich place.
Scary though, one, because they're so intelligent. I remember seeing the clip when the orca comes up, has a look at the seals, and then they all seem to have a chat, and they come back and have a right old go.
Yeah, I was there when that was filmed, actually. It's remarkable. I mean, I'm not trying to be anthropomorphic, but I think orca are the most intelligent animals on this planet, and that includes humans. Their brains are several times larger than ours. They are air-breathing mammals, as I said, like we are. So we evolved in the oceans along with orcas. We came out onto the land, as did orcas, and became air-breathing mammals. And then at some point, we stayed on the land. We made the decision to stay on the land, and orcas went back into the ocean. This planet, it's not planet Earth, is it? It's planet ocean, because 70% of this planet is occupied by the seas and the oceans. And we live on the little dry bits in between. So we stay up here, paying 20% VAT, and orcas have free range of the entire planet. And they live in these wonderful extended family groups called pods. They range wherever they like. They're the apex predator in the oceans. Nothing bothers orcas. So they've developed this. Some say they've developed a language and a culture because they communicate at great speeds and they use echolocation. They see with sound, a bit like bats. So they're remarkable animals, highly evolved. And, it must be nice to be able to swim around the oceans untroubled. The only problem they've got, of course, is the noise pollution that we put into the seas and oceans.
The photographer Herbert Ponting, who went with Scott down to the Antarctic, ended up in one situation where he had his tripod set up on a floe and the orcas were coming up and trying to tip up the edge of the floe so that he would slide off the other end. And because, as far as I'm concerned, you know, human seal, what difference? Actually, at any stage, when you were that close to them, did you feel under threat?
The strangest situation is when they come out of the water. They have this technique when they're looking for seals on the ice called spy hopping. These 7 metre long, 5 tonne orcas will come vertically out of the water and just hang there and halfway out of the water and scan the ice for potential prey. And if you're standing on the edge with a hydrophone or a camera, they look at you, and they look at you directly, and that's one of the, I suppose it is scary, but it's you just freeze, because these animals actually raise themselves above you and look down at you and scan you, obviously sizing you up in terms of their menu, and then just sink back into the oceans. There's no history of orca predating humans, people. I think they're too smart. They realise we're just sort of skin and bone. We're not really like a juicy seal. But when they take a good look at you with their eye, then it's that such close contact with an animal of such intelligence that's quite a stimulating experience. The worst part, one of those, was I was in a similar position a week or so later by an ice hole in the Ross Sea, and a minke whale surfaced to breathe and just exhaled all over me. So I was covered in whale snot, which was worse really than being scanned by an orca.
Sound of orcas in the Ross Sea in Antarctica is recorded by Chris Watson, and that podcast is still available to listen to on BBC Sounds.
I'd forgotten he was talking about it, because I'd seen the film of the kind of like bottling, you know, when the orca come out and scan, but I hadn't taken in properly that they're coming up so high and so close that they're looking down at you.
Yeah.
That must be... It was a scary film to watch, but actually being there and just seeing that intelligence and those eyes scanning you must have been incredible.
Yeah, you know, and that way they had of actually creating the wave. You know, they would work four or five
the
of them
bow
together,
wave, yeah.
Just create a bow wave, tip up the floe, the seal would fall off the other side. Poof, that's it. They've got one of them's got lunch essentially. It's just extraordinary. Coming up, we've got a few more of our favourite podcast moments from last year, and I'm also going to be talking to a chap about the magic of stone circles. This area is infested with them, and yet we know remarkably little about them.
I've got No mystery bird today, but we've got a really difficult sound. Ewan McIntyre got in touch. He said, Happy New Year from the French Pyrenees. Thanks for another great programme. As a one-time Glasgow West End resident, I also really loved Anna Massey's piece, which was brilliant. Anyway, is the mystery sound a metal gas bottle rolling along the ground? That's Ewan. I kind of, it's a big oxygen cylinder, that drum type noise, but you're absolutely, completely wrong. We can tell you it's not that, it's an insect. Have a listen to this.
Barry Sutherland, our South Yorkshire ornithological correspondent, has been in contact to say Happy New Year. I couldn't hazard a guess as to what the mystery sound is, so I'll say it's Ewan rolling out the barrel, or rather, rolling it back in because he's emptied it. I'm also wondering if you guys know anything about the whales at Withernsea. 10 sperm whales were beached there, sir. Ah, that is a shame.
No.
Thanks very much for that. Davy in Skye says, is it the sound from within a beehive? Jenny in Skye says, is it the sound of a Kelly kettle starting to heat up? Not a bad idea. And Lan in Highland, not talking about the sound effect at all here, says, the orcas sound like kittens. Makes me love them even more. From Alana in a chilly Highlands. I do like that. Anyway, we're looking back in some of the interviews.
You don't want to play with them, though.
No, you don't want to play with them. We're looking back in some of the interviews we featured on our Scotland Outdoors podcast last year. Jenny Sturgeon is a singer, a songwriter, and an ecologist. And a few months ago, she just released an album inspired by Nan Shepherd's book, The Living Mountain. Now, Jenny's album also bears the same name.
Yeah, you and Mark and Helen spoke with Jenny in November, and she shared some of the field recordings she used with the album. First up, here's a bird from the plateau, the ptarmigan.
Jenny, you're an ecologist as well as a musician, and I'm wondering how important the types of field recording that you're sharing with us today are to the musical work, how it informs the musical approach.
It definitely does. I think the first kind of project I did that started using field recordings was a commission for the National Trust for Scotland. I went out to St Kilda to celebrate. It was 30 years since they'd been given World Heritage Site status, and they wanted something to mark that, so they asked me to write some music, and I was lucky enough to get out there, and it was very clear that that was such an important part of that place. And I think in order to kind of transport listeners to that place, it was important to have those field recordings of the St Kilda Wren and of the wild, crazy weather in the record. And so I've sort of started doing that ever since then, really. It's just another element, I think, which kind of can draw in listeners and to me anyway, helps place that music in the landscape. And so including things like the ptarmigan call and various different calls in the Living Mountain record just felt like the natural and right thing to do. And it also is one of the things that I use when I'm writing or composing a piece, is I'll have these sounds around me, listening to them through headphones or however, and that helps inform the sound of the piece as well, as much as just the writing that I've done or anything. It's the sounds that I hear that transport me to that place.
The call of the crested tit, very sharp, very precise.
And such incredible little birds. One of my favourite places in the Cairngorms National Park is Abernethy Forest, and I love getting to watch the crested tits, and they're just gorgeous little things, and the way that they use their crests for signalling and just hearing them is a beautiful thing. So, of course, they needed to be involved in the record as well.
Another sound which is very evocative, particularly in autumn in the mountains of Scotland, is the stags roaring as the rut takes place. It can be quite unsettling, actually, if you're not used to it. It's got an almost primeval quality to it. You've got that sound, but you've taken it a step further here with a bit of artistic license and made it sound even weirder.
Well, I think for this track, the birds, animals and insects wanted it to feel a little bit, almost a bit hazy, like on one of those days when you're up in the mountains and you think that you're hearing something, but you can't tell where it's coming from. And particularly, I think that sound of the roaring deer is one of those sounds. You know, it echoes through the valleys and is a really striking sound. So, yeah, we used a bit of poetic license and manipulated some of these calls. So it's a recording by a guy called Magnus Robb, who is a fantastic field recording person, and yeah, he supplied the samples of these different species.
She got Magnus Robb's recordings of red deer there, and then we moved into the sound of snipe, but I mean it's a slightly different take on snipe drumming there.
I think this is one of my favourite sounds, along with the curlew, the snipe drumming, and they create this incredible sound through the vibration of their feathers. I think it's used, I might be wrong, I'm sure some listeners will tell me if I'm wrong, but when the birds are displaying, they create this sound, and there's something just weird and magical about it.
The unworldly sound of snipe drumming, which features in Jenny Sturgeon's album The Living Mountain, based on the book by Nan Shepherd. It's a fabulous sound, isn't it?
It's got to be, you know, one of those stupid questions. If you had to pick a favourite wildlife sound, that has got to be right up there. But the roaring, the rutting of the deer. I was up at Allerdale, and the stalker said, "Oh, the deer are roaring tonight." I said, "Well, go and take me up." He said, "Well, now?" I said, "Yeah." He took me right up into the glen, and it was just one of the iconic sounds of Scotland.
Yeah, too straight. Could we, again, I'm kind of bouncing Ron into this. Ron, is there any chance we could hear this week's mystery sound again? Just, you know, just stick a wee snatch of it up just to remind people. Now, this sound is actually made by an insect. And essentially, we'd like you to guess which insect and what it's actually doing. We've got a very good guess here from Storn, who is saying, "Leanna Vaur, Happy New Year." It says, this is anonymous, "I think the sound could be a wheelbarrow being driven, steered, very quietly, suspiciously." See, there speaks the voice of experience, I would say.
What were you stealing at that point?
It's a handy thing, a wheelbarrow, I'm telling you. You can do it on a bike too, just in case you're wondering. The northeast of Scotland is home to dozens and dozens of what are known as recumbent stone circles. There are many in this area.
just before Christmas, on the shortest day, in fact, 21st of December, I took a trip out to one of them with Hayden Lorimer, who's Chair of Human Geography at Edinburgh University, and it was to a stone circle near Echt.
So here we are, Sunhoney, and we have an enclosure of trees, and set within that enclosure of trees, a ring of stone. There are about 11 standing stones here, impressive in their height and position, some of them tapering to sharpened points rising up to the sky. And the centrepiece of this dramatic stage really in the landscape are two huge flanker stones, and between them, now capsized, is the recumbent stone, the central feature of the site.
The two uprights are huge, but the recumbent stone itself must be about 4 metres long. I don't know how many tons of stone is sitting in that, but it begs the question, did they move it here to a site where they wanted to build the stone circle, or did they build the stone circle where they found that thing sitting? I would tend to go for the latter, but that's just me.
And it's a perfect question, because what you already begin to expose, Mark, is the fact that there are many, many different conjectures about this place, and there are relatively few clues to work with. What the archaeoastronomers, who are the real experts, would tell us is that this great fallen recumbent stone would have been actually upright, and its diagonal side would have created a frame across the sky. It's facing in a south-southwesterly direction, and it was intended absolutely consciously to be put here for a particular astral event, the standstill moon, occurring every 18.6 years, where the moon follows a trajectory low, 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 extremely low in the sky. And at that point, this stage catches light. It becomes a place with real intention and meaning and drama, if it doesn't have it already.
There is no Rosetta Stone for these things. There's nothing that allows us to sort of decode it, to unpick it. When I've been to lots of these standing stones. I'm from the northeast, and the northeast is where you find them, these recumbent stone circles. The first thing I instinctively looked for in that direction was a dip somewhere on a ridge, somewhere on the horizon, because these things are not built on the top of hills. They're almost invariably surrounded by other hills.
Yes.
So to a certain extent, it's counterintuitive, but it's really bugging not knowing what they were for.
But you know, in their silence and in their stillness, maybe what we're left with is we're lost for words. Yeah. We're rendered speechless. We're prisoners of our own language, in that we struggle to describe, far less to explain, the structure of meaning that made this place. What we have maybe is a structure of feeling, actually. There's no question these are emotionally charged sites.
Something like this is a massive community effort. Nobody did this. Nobody could do this by themselves. So this took huge chunk new. This took large numbers of people, quite a considerable amount of time and effort to create. And the question keeps on coming back, why? Why did they do it?
Well, I think if we're going to come up with a reasonable theory, then it's about cycles and circularity. Mm-hmm. We are standing here at the heart of a ring, and we can turn inward, and we can perhaps begin to understand something of its ritual meaning. Mm. But also we can look outward. And you said that perhaps we can turn to the topography, right? Yeah. And we can understand it in those terms. We can look to skylines. We can look to hilltops. We can look to ridges. But we can also understand it according to time. It sits within a greater wheel of the year. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's midwinter. We're at a hinge point.
Literally the bleak midwinter.
We're right in the bleak midwinter. We're about to have the deepest, darkest night. But that's an invitation, actually, to turn upward again, to an even bigger wheel or rim around us, the cosmos. So this was, in effect, a roofless temple by which communities understood themselves, and they understood themselves within a far greater form of being. So there's a sense of an ancient intelligence here, which is incredibly sophisticated and might leave us just wondering, how far do we differ from them? How close or distant are we from them? They're nice questions to contemplate afternoon like this.
Aidan Lorimer, and you can hear more of our musings at the Sun, Honey, Stone Circle coming up later in the programme. This mystery sound is causing absolute pandemonium. Kath says, is it a high-tech recording of sap flowing in a tree? It's a good guess, Kath, but we did say it was an insect. Mary de Bartonshire picked up on that clue and says, is it a dung beetle rolling a ball of dung? Good one, huh? Stuart Robertson, who also ignored the insect clue, says, is it a beer can getting blown down a quiet street during the night? You can see where he's going on that one. If you slowed it down a bit, it could actually be that. And Robin and Fife says that there is a walled sensory garden for the blind at Silverburn near Leven, which had a water feature in a corner which made this sound. I hear the electric motor which ran the pump. The water, he thinks, may have run through large bamboo pipes. These are all excellent guesses, but not one of them even vaguely close.
Yeah, and I think the fact that the clue, which he said, it's an insect, maybe gives away that it's not a beer barrel rolling down a deserted street, but you can see where you're coming from.
You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElroy. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, there's no excuses, there's nowhere to hide. You can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We ask every week for you to tell us where you listen to the podcasts. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Phil Riley in British Columbia did. He says, from the past several months, I've been enjoying listening to the podcast from Vancouver, British Columbia. What a joy it's been to return home to Scotland each episode. Originally from Aberdeen, my wife's from Dumbarton. Never before has the distance from our family and friends across Scotland felt so far away. You've helped bridge the gap and have made home a little more accessible. Thank you.
Yeah, that's the programme that makes you greet wherever you are in the world. And the film goes on and said, if you ever like a wee excerpt of life out here on the west coast of Canada, just let me know. Well, we would, yeah, get in touch. You can always find me out and about on the coastal mountains. Cheers, Phil.
And we return to our favourite moments from our Scotland Outdoors podcast last year now. Helen and I were lucky enough to speak to folk singer Corinne Polwart in September. And we were just, at that stage, we were just kind of clinging on to the last vestiges of summer, but also looking forward to the changing of the seasons.
Yeah, here is you getting very excited about geese with Corinne.
I live on what's known as the Buchan Plain. So, you know, if I get out the house and climb the hill slightly and look north, there's about 30, 40 miles of just more or less flat land coming down from the Grampians, which is just scoured flat by the glaciers. So if you stand on the hill when the geese are returning, you just get V after V after V of birds coming in. To me, it's one of the sort of key turning points of the year.
One of the key features of Fala Moor is that 2% of the world's population of pink-footed geese come to overwinter on the moor. And I totally agree with you. For me, the point in autumn when you hear the first skein flying over, I get a little wee chill up my back every time that happens. And from Fala Moor, you get this amazing vista of the Forth Valley, so it's the same kind of feeling of V after V of geese coming in to rest either at Fala or over at Aberlady or at Gladhouse Reservoir further into Mid Lothian. So there's these resting spots right across Lothian for the geese. And the geese that come here, the same ones that come by you, they come from Iceland and
Greenland. I was fascinated by that journey and fascinated by the place names that the geese would follow on their journey to get to this point. So that's built into this little piece. And to me, the thing about the goose skein is that the formation, the V formation that we know, is aerodynamically an incredible evolved mechanism, because each of the geese, in the way that they fly with their wings outstretched, they break the wind for the geese in behind. So they literally create these pockets of wind resistance for the geese in behind them. And they shift constantly. One leads and then falls back and another leads. And this whole idea that no single goose is responsible for the well-being of all the geese, they act together as a unit. It just seemed to me like a beautiful metaphor for the best of human endeavours. And for me, the best of human endeavour is universal healthcare. So that's explicitly referenced in this piece.
Every goose takes a turn. Stepping up, falling back, labouring and resting. Stepping up, falling back, labouring and resting. Like sky-born socialists, no lone bird bears the brunt. Holding on, holding on. It's a gorgeous symbiotic.
I love the fact that you've used so much rich sound effect within that, and particularly the sound of the beating wing. Did you actually capture that? How did you get that sound?
The sound whiz in the team is Pippa Murphy rather than myself. Most of the sound for the album in the theatre was gathered from the moor. So there are other birds in the sound piece. So for example, the larks and the red grouse and the plovers and curlews, and all of these sounds are gathered from the moor. But the geese, I confess, they were not gathered by us. They were sourced from other sound archives. We couldn't quite afford the kind of flying sound set up for our wee theatre piece for Edinburgh. Maybe next time. Yeah, we hide in the big guns.
There's a musicality in that sound itself, the rhythm there of the beating. Do you draw on that sense of musicality from the sounds of bird songs and the sounds of the natural world around you in your songwriting?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think what I draw on, perhaps, is the feeling that I get from the sound, maybe rather than the sound itself. I draw, I guess, on the dynamic swoop that you get, because that's one of the big things for me about the geese. When they take off from the moor, if you're lying in the heather as they take off, it's the most incredible feeling, having that wash over you. So I've loved the collaborative process, actually, of working with Pippa, because her kind of art and craft background is quite different from mine. So she's trained in sound design, but also in classical composition. So she's working with much, much bigger sound palettes than I am as a folk musician. And what I've loved is the way that we've brought our two different kind of crafts together in making the work about Fala. And she is able to conjure some of that sense of swoop and wash and feeling, which I can do better, to be honest, with words than with sound.
Kareen Paulwart there with music from her album A Pocket of Wind Resistance, and that interview was taken from the Scotland Outdoors podcast we did with Kareen back in September. She is just a fabulous artist.
It's fantastic. It took me back to years and years ago when we were trying to create the sound of an owl, giant owl, and we couldn't find anything. So we got my dad's old motorcycle gloves, you know, ancient
the gauntlets, things, yeah,
and put them, yeah, the gauntlets either side of the microphone, and went, whoop, whoop, and it was just, you know, it's the joy of being on radio and playing with sounds. It's great. We've got a strange one here from Duncan Stewart. Now, Duncan says, Mystery Sound, good morning team, look forward to your broadcast 2021. First I thought it was one of you guys on your bicycle, but you say it's an insect.
It's not breathing hard enough.
A beetle grub chewing in his or her tunnel. Yeah, that's a definite possibility. But he signs off, and I don't know if we're being had here or not, Duncan McCatt from Nairn.
I don't know. Don't know. Who would know? Keith in Hertfordshire says, think the mystery insect is a hummingbird moth. Lil in Forest says, think the mystery sound is a dung beetle rolling its dung and doing its thing. That's Lil Kenyon and a half 15-conscious-year-old. Katie Perth says, think it may be a wasp either chewing wood or building a nest. Happy New Year. Ian Ross says, also thinks it's a wasp chewing wood. Karen Badakro Gerlich says, is it a masonry bee? Neil says, I think the recording is a swarm of bees that have landed on a transformer. Sadly, no. Paul Forgandenny, love the show. Is it the sound of a termite eating wood? David Long also thinks it's a dung beetle rolling some of its collection downhill. It's a brilliant New Year's Day walk in the snowy border hills yesterday to banish the remains of 2020. Anne in Helensburgh thinks it's a wasp eating wood. And Mary Frame, Gifford in East Lothian, says, is the mystery sound a moth or butterfly emerging from the pupa? All the best. These are good guesses. None of them right,
certainly. Good guesses. All of them stunningly wrong, but there's still time to give us a call. 0808 592 95 00. Now, we're now going back to your visit to Sun Honey Stone Circle in Aberdeenshire in the company of Hayden Lorimer from Edinburgh University. And you're pondering the significance of the stone circle.
I did some research on this. In back in the 19th century, you know, archaeologists, actually, or probably antiquarians in those days, dug out the centre of this and found evidence of burning and of bones, possibly cremation. Don't rightly, could have been feasting, don't rightly know. But again, it's just because that was left, because this has got several thousand years of history, at one stage does not mean that was its original intention.
That's right. And in some respects, I think that we ought to think of these places not only as ruins, that we might see this now in 2020 as a 4,000-year-old ruin through which time has passed. But we might also conceive of it, first of all, as a site of ritual, but we might also think of it as a construction site. Imagine this place with scaffolding, right? You know, what was the afternoon when a gaffer stood here And she put a flint behind her ear and she looked at her crew of fellow women folk and said, tell you what, let's knock off for the day. You know, it in many respects, these sites scramble. And they scramble our understanding of who we are, but they might also give us cause to reflect on how these places have been considered significant or insignificant across time. That there are some 80 recumbent stone circles in the northeast of Scotland. So at different points, these circles have been hugely valued, cherished and prized places, and at other points in time, they've been relatively insignificant.
We're still standing beside the recumbent stone here. So you get two uprights and the recumbent stone in the middle. There is another section here, I think, that came off that. It's actually broken off there, but that didn't fall like that accidentally. I wonder if that's been split, possibly for a lintel at some stage, you know, and because somebody's tried moving it so far and eventually thought, no, it's too big.
Yeah. And though we can't properly see it also on this capsized recumbent stone, there are 28 cup marks. In fact, just
I should have brought some water up.
We can see some of them. If I kneel down onto the stone here, we can see these shallow depressions.
Yeah. If you pour water onto this, it just brings it to life.
And there is no strong or definitive theory for what these cup marks signify. Some people say it's a celestial map by which you could understand the star system. Others think, that's hokum, it won't work as a theory. They are things that perhaps, if we just stick our fingers in there, maybe the best thing we can do is feel a connection, but have no explanation.
You know, I've looked at these many, many times, and the one that makes probably most sense to me is, you know, much the same over the last 15, 20 years, there's been a developed sort of ritual in our modern society that if somebody sadly dies in a car accident, then they start putting up almost like a roadside shrine. Mm. They put up flowers, they put up photographs, they put up little crosses and things. I wonder if this was people in the community saying, Granny's passed away, I'll just mark her passing on this stone because the stone's going to be here long after I'm gone. Mm. And that way Granny's remembered. Mm. Each of these marks indicates somebody important. I don't know. It's a theory.
I think it's a lovely thought. You know, in many respects, these stone circles, they might point us towards art, sex, death, myth, mystery, time, the cosmos, you name it. We can find the fundaments of life here. It is an incredibly powerful place to spend some time. And you know, maybe what we have here is just one small example, actually, of the appeal of local acres. Over the course of the last few months, I'm a geographer, and I tend to work with the there rather than the here. But during lockdown,
you've got no option.
I've got no option. I've got to hang out in my local acre. And so I've become a hobbyist. I've become a hobbyist of stone circles among other parts of these incredible lithic landscapes of the northeast of Scotland. So in some respects, I'd like to share with people the thought that there's so much to be found really close at hand. They're great places just to spend time and have a wee quiet thought to ourselves.
Aidan Lorimer, Chair of Human Geography at Edinburgh University there. And I've been in quite a few of the stone circles around about Aberdeenshire, but by no means all, Ewan.
Well, no, I mean, there's a lot we've lost as well. You know, some of them have been pulled down, ploughed over. But they are just fascinating places. But it's frustrating as well, because, you know, so many questions and so few answers. You would have thought, over the hundreds of years or thousands of years that they've been studied, you could come up with a definitive answer as to what they were for. What were the cup marks? Why did somebody spend so much time chipping away to make a circle or to make a cup mark? I mean, I quite like your theory about the passing of a relative. I'm not totally convinced, but...
of course not.
So many questions.
Yeah, well, I mentioned right in the first section there that, you know, there is no equivalent to the Rosetta Stone. And, you know, that refers back to, I think it was Napoleon's troops in Egypt, and a stone was discovered, and it had, you know, writing on one side, pardon me, and hieroglyphics on the other side, and for the first time they were able to decode one of the languages because they had access to the first. And there's nothing like that with us. There's nothing that would say, yes, this is why we were doing it. And the fact that we're doing it, I'm sorry, I'm sitting in the smoke, the fact that we're doing it, say, 4,000 years ago, doesn't mean that that was the exact same significance 3,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago, because people change. People adapt these traditions and practices all the time.
Yeah, what I didn't understand, you maybe explained to me, the recumbent stones, you have two big sticky-up stones, and it sort of looks like a big, huge stone table in between them. But you're suggesting that it wasn't always a table, they were upright.
Well, no, Hayden suggested that, and I must give it, I'd never heard that before. Because I'd always made the assumption that the recumbent stones were exactly that. You've got the, you know, the long, really massive sort of monolith, you know, the two uprights on either side. That just feels right to me. The fact that it's supposed to have collapsed, I'm not, I again, like you, I'm not entirely convinced about that, but there you go. As you know, we're very...
Yeah, but who's the expert here?
Yeah. Well, that's the point. There really isn't an expert here because we don't have the equivalent of the Rosetta Stone. You know, anybody's theory is as valid as anybody's else, practically. We're very keen on delving into the folklore and mythology of the country that we have. The wealth of the stories we have in Scotland is amazing, just like this one coming up. And this morning, Ewan is taking us to Shetland.
As dawn broke on the bare hillside above Loch Spiggy in the south of Shetland, a lone figure was sitting on a large rock above the burn of Nuss. It was late. The January sun of this land crawls slowly into the sky after a long, long night of darkness. The stone was large and overhung a small pool, water dark from the peats on the heights above and teeming with trout, the brown trout of Shetland. And on this rock, the Wolverstane, sat a man with his rod fishing. Fishing for breakfast, patiently, for this angler was in no hurry. As the early trout rose to take the rare insects of the cold season, he dropped his fly into the ripple, striking quickly at the 4-pound fish, which instantly pounced on this rare meal. Minutes later, this delightful fish of the lochs was on the grass, destined for a dusting of oatmeal and a pan of butter. But as the beams of the rising sun grew and strengthened, it revealed a man like no other. In fact, it was no man. This child of the hills had never lived in a cottage, never worked the fields, never graced a church. For this was a being outside the accepted norms of Shetland life. For this was a wolver, starting his day simply fishing for breakfast. Strong, muscled, powerful limbs under a coat of thick, dark hair. The body of a man, but the head of a wolf. The wolver, the wolf man of the Isles. But the wolver was unlike the man-wolf, the werewolves of Europe, the shape-shifting beings that move from man to beast in search of flesh. For the wolver of this stream has always been. His ancestors stretching back into the mists of time, a time when wolves roamed this land in search of deer, elk and wild boar. Over the decades, the wolves evolved, as ape to man, so wolf to wolver, from four limbs on the land to two, from crouched to erect, from canine to wolver, the body of man with the head of wolf. From lethal killer to kind and caring. The man of wolf lives in caves and crannies, seeking a simple life and an opportunity to help. Many a poor family in Shetland, struggling to put food on the table, would find a gift of trout or salmon on the doorstep of the croft each morning. For the wolver of Shetland wants nothing more than to be left alone and to help. He'll plough the field at night, catch escaped cattle, and watch over children as they wind their way to school in the morning darkness, and guiding lost travellers home. The wolver was much loved and treasured in this land. But sadly, it would appear this man from the wolf is no more. At least not commonly seen. The last recording sighting was in the 1930s, of the wolver in his cave high above the loch. A society which has sadly moved on. But there are still those who go to bed hungry, who will leave a window open and may find fish on the windowsill in the morning. And those lost in the swirling mist of January winter still hope that out of the murk will emerge a wolver to lead them to safety. Many say the wolvers have gone, but many more hope and pray they're still in the hills.
I had never heard of that before. So effectively, it's only kind of wolf man.
Yeah, it's a wolf man, but it's not like the werewolf, which is a bad anti-human thing. This is just parallel evolution. They evolved from the wolves as we evolved from the apes, and they're kind and gentle souls. And they just love fishing for the trout up there, and just a great thing, and hopefully they are still there.
Yeah. Very often with that kind of folk legend, you can see, you know, it's almost like a warning that, you know, don't go there because such and such will get blah, blah, blah. But that one I'm struggling to get my head around, you know, just with, what the logic behind that one might be, but never mind. There's umpteen comments coming in about the mystery sound. Jake and Bucky says, is it a hummingbird moth? Happy New Year to all on the great programme. Sandy Main Blair Gowrie says, is the sound a cabbage white butterfly? Very specific, Sandy, well done. Recently emerged from its chrysalis stage, thrashing about while its wings are hardening in preparation for flight. Sadly no, Sandy. Norman and Orkney says, I think it's an earwig having its dinner. That's actually not too bad. That's, and Rob Parkinson in Rafford says, is the mystery sound a turning millstone? But yeah. I am declaring two people the winners this week because they've got the absolute closest to it. Robert in Edinburgh says, is the mystery sound a group of ants rolling something? And Judith in Eden Garden says, could the mystery sound be an ant dragging some material back to its ant's nest?
Yeah, well, Keith Sutherland and Blair Gowrie said, Happy New Year. Is it a wood ant dragging pine needles across the forest floor?
Well, the reason...
And Sue Herod says, is it a mystery ant moving a large blue caterpillar down into its nest?
Well, artist Jez Riley French works across the world recording sounds from Italian cable cars to the sound between buildings in Japan. And as we will hear shortly, the sound of ants eating an apricot. Helen and I discussed the idea of something called durational recording with them, where you spend hours and hours and hours in an environment recording. As Jez explains, this kind of work, he actually finds incredibly cathartic.
He used to run this distribution company in the music industry, and that became very stressful. And we ended up selling the business, and also it was the same time that my mum unfortunately passed away. So there was a lot of changes in my life. And what I found was is that on location listening and field recording just meant I had to stop, because you have to be still and you have to be quiet, unless you want the sounds of yourself in the piece, you know. So I don't know if I'd describe myself as patient. I'm quite a private chap and quite quiet, you know. I like a quiet kind of life, I guess. The first sort of 20 minutes are actually the hardest, because that's when all of your natural instinct to kind of move or do something are there. After 20 minutes, it's quite easy to suddenly find it's been an hour and then longer, you know.
It's not often that Helen and I disagree, but I was surprised when she said patience, because, again, it kind of presupposes that you're sitting there doing nothing. You know, you are waiting or whatever, rather. Maybe you are doing something. I mean, I was thinking about somebody else who's been on this podcast some time ago, Jim Crumley, who's a wildlife writer. You know, and you read Jim's books, and they're full of really extraordinary wildlife encounters where, you know, there's a peregrine falcon following an eagle and mimicking its flight pattern. That kind of thing, you know, almost taking the mickey out of it. And you think, how do you spot that? But if you read between the lines with Jim says, sat down on a wall to just look at the view, got up 3 hours later. Now, most people don't do that, but he's not sitting doing nothing. He's absorbing all the time. It's a very active process.
Yeah, it is active. This is actually quite relevant to the sort of current conversations around field recording. And not to be critical, but there's obviously a lot of people using field recording and field listening, or, you know, listening to environments for relaxation. That's fine, you know, that's fine. But if you're going to really listen to a location, as in rather than imposing your own ideas onto it, then it is an act. It's an active act. You know, it's not relaxing. It's quite tiring actually, because there's a lot going on. It's almost like going to see a long symphony rather than watching a 2 minute song. You know, it's the attention is quite active and draws on your resources, but that's the point of it. You know, it's the point of it is not to come out pacified; it's to come out activated by the landscape.
Oh, it's just so interesting, isn't it? Actually, because of the way that we live, so much of the time everything's so fast paced and so immediate and quick, isn't it? This is potentially a bit of an antidote to that.
Yeah, slow listening, as they say. The thing is, when you talk about it, it does sound quite intense and everything, but it's miraculous, you know, that giving time to a place, it also involves giving time to yourself. And although it might sound to some people who haven't done it or are not interested in it, it might sound crazy to sit and listen to ants for 8 hours. You know, I mean, I'm not suggesting people go out and do that necessarily. But if you just give it a bit more time than you used to, you will find that you'll hear a lot more and your connection to those places will change. Whether it becomes stronger or not is down to your own sort of personal activism or political views, maybe on the environment, stuff like that. But you will certainly hear them differently. And that's kind of the point, isn't it? We're all learning all the time, and that's kind of crucial as well.
Is that actually a piece title, Ants Eating an Apricot?
It is indeed, yeah.
It's as if, you know, and next week we're going to be ants eating a plum, you know.
Well, I have done the meeting of strawberries.
It might be different, who would know?
Yeah, no, I have done the meeting of strawberries as well, and it is different.
How and where did you record that?
That was actually for a festival in Italy, an arts festival in the Dolomites in Italy. I'd turned up to do a field recording piece. I didn't know what I was going to record because I never do that. I tried to go to locations without expectations. But in the village square, there was this apricot tree and obviously, because of the season, some of the apricots had fallen onto the ground and were being eaten by ants. So I just thought, well, there you go, ready-made installation. So I put set the microphones up underneath one of these, the contact microphones I'm using, and set them up underneath the apricot and then just filmed this 8-hour installation of ants devouring an apricot.
And you can hear more from Jez on the Scotland Outdoors podcast from noon today. It's just, I think it's wonderful that, you know, you can make a job out of a sound of, you know, here's an ant eating an apricot.
I can almost guarantee there is no other network in the world broadcasting the sound of fruit being eaten. I mean, what a rock and roll thing to do.
We had a fabulous conversation at the beginning of this programme where the producer, Fiona, said, Sam, who's answering the phones, wants to know how specific you want them to be. And I said, how do you mean? He said, well, you know, an ant eating an apricot, an ant eating a plum, that kind of thing. If it's a plum, just throw them straight out. They've got to be absolutely on the money. Ants was close enough, we felt.
That's a very different programme yet again. But what a way to start the new year. Yeah. Apricots been eaten live.
Yeah. If you have just joined us, we started off this programme by saying we hope you have a happy new year. Yes, exactly. Why? Hope you've got a happy new year. We hope you do. You know, it's not going to be the same and it's probably going to be difficult in different ways. But take care of yourselves. And from all of the team here in Aberdeen, thank you very much for listening.